This is with Giancarlo Nava and Ryan Goins.
Welcome to the Heat Beat Podcast. I'm your host, Giancarlo Nava. With me today, we have co-founder and producer, Mr. Brian Goins. How are you, sir?
You get to hear me, guys, more.
Yes, Brian's going to talk more. Brian's usage is going up today because the only other person on the program today is Mr. Chris Whittingham. Chris, you're in so many places now. Where do I say? Where are you from?
I am of myself.
Okay, you are of yourself.
Yeah, I mean, to specify one outlet would be unfair to the other. So I am of CBS Sports, BN Sports, occasionally on Univision as well, and... Yeah, Univision, I should say, like that as well. Appearing occasionally on 560 WQAM as well. So, yeah, I'm all over. I'm piecing it together.
Yes, Chris Whittingham. He's like you're a journeyman of the NBA, except all at the same time.
Right, exactly. I would say it's like I don't want to flatter myself and call myself Draymond Green, but I am doing that number of things, but much more poorly.
Draymond Green light.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, let's go with that.
With like a hint of Courtney Lee, because he's been everywhere.
Right, exactly. Right. Well, who is the player most associated with having been everywhere?
That's what I was about to ask you, because like when I think journeyman, I just think Courtney Lee.
I think of Drew Gooden for some reason.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a really good one.
Drew Gooden's good. Gerald Green also. Well, actually, no. Boston's the second place he repeated. He was. Yeah, that's a.
I feel like I remember seeing a cover of a book, I forget by who, where it was like, hey, I was an NBA journeyman, and here are all the like eight jerseys that I wore during the course of my career, along with me in the picture of the book. I don't know why I remember that. I don't remember who the player was, but it sticks out in my head. And I don't know who like the modern day equivalent of that is.
Do you remember that day that Luke Ridnour got that week that Luke Ridnour
Luke Ridnour is an excellent example of this.
He was like on five different teams in a week.
I loved Luke Ridnour's expiring contract was my favorite trade talk day of deadline day ever. It was so good.
He's like the last asset standing. Like he was moved. That was so funny. Do you think he got on a plane do you think after the third time he's like, I'm gonna stay put to see where I am?
Right. I'll wait for 3 p.m. on Tuesday to figure out which hotel I need to be staying at and where I'm going to move my family, like, if
who,
at all.
Who covers Steve those? I can only think of Portland and the Lakers.
Seven teams.
Seven. Steve
what?
Blake? What are the teams? Do you have them?
I'm looking at a list from the richest.
Oh, great way to go.
They have him on a Warriors jersey.
He was on the Warriors?
His career earnings was $32 million.
So let's pull up Steve Blake's teams. I did not think this is where we were going to start. Washington, Portland, Milwaukee, Denver.
See, I don't know like half of those.
Yeah, I don't remember any of that. I remember Portland. The Lakers for a while, and then the Warriors, then Portland again, then Detroit. He had three different stints with Portland. He got traded from Portland to Milwaukee.
That sounds right. Go back for like the last year of their career to a place where I remember them being. I feel like that's a thing in the NBA.
three times?
Yeah.
I don't know about three times, but yeah.
Like,
I
mean, he went back at 34 years old and just played a season and then retired in Detroit, which I don't remember.
I'm mad at Basketball Reference because I go to them for everything and I don't even know what to punch in right now. Like, what do I punch in? Do I go to Player Season Finder and like say, like, give me most number of teams with one player?
What would we be without Basketball Reference?
Oh, I mean, I kid you not, I'm there probably... Every time I go to work, I go to Basketball Reference because I think of something. And the Play Index is, for me, like the
so
number
good.
One tool in the history of sports. Because, you find everything. Any kind of, like... My first job in radio, or my first like kind of the first time I got hired, was to do the 790 morning show. I don't know if you remember this, when Stugatz and Hawk were doing both the morning and the afternoon show. So I was interning for the afternoon show at the time, and they're like, "Hey, do you need any help in the morning?" And so they said yes. I went there for day one and as an intern, and day two they hired me. And so my job every day, was to put together like tidbits on Miami Heat playoff games, like, you know, here are, you know, like eight statistical pieces of information, and this is all basketball reference related. And it was always like, oh, LeBron had 33, 8, and 7 last night. Let me look up the last time somebody did that. And because it's such an arbitrary group of statistics, there's only like three people ever that did that. And if you also include the three steals that he got, then it was also like, oh, there's only like two people ever that did that too. So, and Basketball Reference is so perfect for that, to find those like arbitrary, only three other people have ever done this kind of statistic. Yes.
That's like classic Elias, like ESPN. They always do that. But like they include like shooting 57%. Like,
right, exactly. Yeah, which is clearly it's like Basketball Reference gives you four tools. So I'm just going to put all four of the incredible stats in there and see what it tells me.
I'm going to make this special, damn it. I will make this exclusive. Yeah.
What you saw tonight was unique.
I will make you feel good.
Right.
Oh my God. Did they ever use, because like Hawk and Stugatz aren't numbers guys. Like, did you do that in vain or were they used?
No. They used them because like it was kind of like those kind of ESPN stats and info kind of nuggets that I would find. And it was really only used to back up their arguments. Now here's and here's classic something radio that I would argue with. I don't think that they are not numbers guys. I just don't think that they care enough to put in the time to go and find them. Whereas if someone presents you with the information and says, hey, here's one page of information and all the things you need to need, all you have to do is read one page. Anyone can do that. And so I feel like at that point they used them. Like, and it was always very satisfying as a producer. Like, when you don't have an on-air role, the only thing you want is to contribute to the show in some capacity. And they would, like, throw me a bone every once in a while and read up my numbers.
That's nice. But, like, to your point, I think you're right to an extent, but I think people want numbers to validate what they think. So if you're talking to the guy in the barbershop, I remember Charles Barkley, they told him a couple seasons back that Houston's defense was top 10 in the league by defensive efficiency, but because their pace was so high, they were allowing like 100 points very frequently. And I remember Barkley yelling, like, they're not a good defensive team, they're allowing 100 points. And like, I think it was Ernie or Kenny, it's like saying, but the graphic defensive efficiency is this. And he's like, I don't care about – like, I think some people are just like, if something doesn't make sense to them, they're not willing to concede that their eyes are wrong.
Well, and it's also challenging – it's also challenging your worldview, right? Because if you're Charles Barkley, you grew up thinking, well, if you gave up 100 points, you had a bad defensive day. And that's like a measurement that people would use. And to get people to understand, no, but number of possessions in a game, like it to me, like the best way to explain it would be like on a per possession basis. Like every time you're on defense, this is what you give up and this is where they rank in the league. But for whatever reason, like just the 48 minutes in front of you is good enough to think, okay, this is what happened in the game. It's not this other abstract statistic that I now have to learn. Like, to me, it's the learning and the challenging of what you already think. I think it's been a lot easier for us as young people because we kind of grew up with this ability to know this information, whereas you didn't spend 20 years thinking one thing and then have some other number, which, you know, number in sports is a pejorative in some ways, where it's the dorks trying to take over, whereas I think we kind of have taken in this information. You know, you mentioned an example of like that being challenged. I remember Jeff Van Gundy was on with Zach Lowe, and they were talking about the Eastern Conference All-Stars this year. And they were saying that, you know, Jeff Van Gundy was saying Joel Embiid cannot be an All-Star because he doesn't play for a winning team. Like, he has this very, you know, hard, fast rule. If you don't play for a winning team, you aren't an All-Star. And so Zach Lowe read him the on-off statistics. You know, when Joel Embiid was on the floor, the Sixers were +6. And when Joel Embiid is off the floor, the Sixers are -270. And even Jeff Van Gundy, statistically obtuse, went, oh, yeah, I guess Joel Embiid's an All-Star then. Because, like, that also makes sense. Like, if you just sort of phrase it in those kinds of ways where it's like, well, this is what happens on the court, this is what happens off the court, you can measure a player's value that way.
That's why
statistically obtuse?
That's a good one.
Yeah, yeah, I like obtuse. Ever since I saw Shawshank Redemption, I use obtuse a lot.
Word
I like obtuse.
Ben Dossett, our favorite Utah writer. That guy has like half of his Twitter muted after that day.
What happened? I forget. I remember that very vaguely. What was the story with that?
This is my favorite. I think we've told this like twice on the pod, and I don't care because I love it. I think his name's Ben Dossett, right, Brian? Whatever. Some Utah writer posted some Rudy Gobert stats for the season, and our writer Christian Hernandez quote tweeted it with Hassan's numbers that were very comparable. So he quote tweets the Hassan stats to juxtapose the Gobert stats, and the Dossett guy gets mad and says Heat fans are being obtuse. Like, why do you have to compare? Like, I'm just talking about Rudy Gobert. And
they call him a psychopath.
Yeah, he called him a psychopath. Like, we were like, what is wrong? So obviously Heat Twitter takes the arms like anything because we want to fight.
I've been on the receiving end of that before.
Well, yeah. Well, you turned out to be right. How does that feel?
It turned out to be right about what?
About Dwayne.
Oh, and no. To me, the one I remember the most. Well, and I don't. Was I right about Dwayne? I don't know.
Season you were wrong, but this season you're right.
Yeah. Well, that play. Like, I've now kind of changed my thing. And we can get into this later more. Like, actually thinking about playoff basketball in different terms. I used to not do that. And I for whatever reason this year it kind of dawned on me. But the one where I received it the most was I remember with Whiteside. I made a joke after a game that the Heat lost, but Whiteside had 22-17, and I joked that that Whiteside was happy even though the Heat lost in the game. And Eric Reed, the Heat's TV announcer, got mad at me and was saying, "Why would you accuse him of something like that?" And like, you know, kind of, you know, got strident with me. And all of a sudden, like, on descended, like, all of, you know, Heat Twitter, how dare you, critic? And, like, it was, I was just bombarded with, how could you say Hassan was stat chasing when, I gotta be honest with you, Giancarlo, I went to a couple of games this year, and on, like, at least three occasions in every game that I went to, he's wrestling with a teammate for a rebound, so it counts for him. But, like there's no question he stat pads.
Of course. But, yeah, it happens frequently, so It's kind of unfair to do that to Hassan, but it's still funny how defensive Eric Reed gets.
Yeah, I mean, well, and I understand it, right? Like, it also kind of shines in awards time. Like, I remember I saw some of the Heat people, you know, campaigning for Hassan to be third team All-NBA center. Like, I understand, like, in as part of that position, you have to kind of, you know, take up the causes of the team and say, you know, and also you know more, right? Because you're on the team flights or whatever, and you're with the team every day, so it makes sense. Which, by the way, is why I think are you ready for this hot take? I think NBA and local announcers. First off, I don't think there should be local announcers in any sport.
Whoa.
I think all of the announcers should be hired by the NBA. And sent to every team, and every year you switch teams that you cover. So, like, the NBA hires a stable of 30 announcers, 30 play-by-play people, 30 analysts, and 30 sideline reporters, and every year they change the team that they cover. Because, I don't think, like, getting a slanted version of a broadcast should exist. That's just my own personal opinion. I don't like it, like, as a viewer. I don't like it. Like, here's the Heat's guys, and by the way, the Heat to me are like, and I noticed this more because I worked at CBS at nights, and so we get the feeds from all around the country, right? And like San Antonio, or like even like gigantic homers, like Tony Fiorentino, to his credit, will like say when the referees are right against the Heat, like he'll say, "Oh, that's a good call by the referee. You know, James Johnson clearly fouled him." And that's not something you'd hear on a lot of broadcasts. But I just don't think like the concept in general should exist.
I don't know, because while I do agree with you that you want the most objective broadcast possible, when the guys are with the team all year and when they're with the team for extended periods of time, they have an understanding of what they're dealing with, right? So like when we go to when a Heat game goes to like Mike Breen and Jeff Van Gundy, right? They don't, like, they're surprised by James Johnson, while Eric Reed and Tony aren't, like, because they kind of understand. And
they know the intimate details of the team.
Exactly, because they cover them every day. And they so Hassan, Eric, and Tony are more qualified than anyone to make a comment of Hassan wouldn't have done that before, or point out things like, if Hassan sets a good pick, they go out of their way to point it out, because we as a viewer know Hassan always did not set the best screens. So,
but what I'm saying is like
all year.
To me, like you can have the same crew call the team for all year, but then next year they do the Phoenix Suns games, like, and it's like on a rotation where every year you change the team that you cover, because like it's sort of like beat writing, right? Like you cover the team for the Miami Herald, like you follow them around all year, but you're not necessarily part of the team.
Brian, do you like that idea?
I feel like I shouldn't comment on this part.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, this is probably the one I asked you the worst question.
Oh, man. Poor Brian. Brian.
That was genuinely an
I'm going to keep myself in arm's length from this comment.
Is this being taken out in post?
No, of course
no,
not.
Fine.
Chris, you know we run
with
everything.
Very interesting.
Okay, all right,
I just don't have an opinion about it. You want to talk about culture, though?
No, I don't want to talk about
Why
culture.
Why not? Oh, do you know how the Heat shafted us with culture, Chris?
What? So, oh, did they do copyright infringement?
Yeah, dude. But it wasn't even fantastic. It wasn't even copyright. Like, we had the shirt up for like a week, and listen. The Heat Beat Culture shirt is a limited edition because I think only 5 people have it, and the second day it got taken down for copyright infringement, and we checked to make sure that there wasn't a copyright on culture. And I still
trademark,
I'm sorry. There's still not a trademark, or at least there wasn't after...
Still isn't a trademark.
There still doesn't have a trademark. So somebody filed a claim just to release their shirt.
Did you use their logo?
No.
Or did you just use the word culture?
We used our logo. We didn't even write Miami Heat. We wrote MHB, Miami Heat Beat. And okay. We had like a little design, and then we had culture.
So how does that happen then?
I don't know, but we didn't want to pick a fight with them.
That's a good point. Yeah, I guess you can pick your battles
the
there.
The corporate
I mean,
machine
what,
wins.
Like, once something becomes said enough, it will become a T-shirt.
Well, we want to make a culture shirt, but we want to like capitalize the CULT in culture, so we spell cult.
That is what it is. It's a cult of culture. Both among the team and the fans.
We sound like Heat fans sound like a cult when they talk about the culture stuff. It's kind of
I know, but that's why it makes me crazy. That's why like I don't like it. Because you're kind of mythologizing and deifying a thing that's like it's a basketball team. They play basketball. And sure, they're overachievers. No question they're overachievers. Are they fun to watch? Without question, but it doesn't need to be like some bigger than life force, the culture. Like, the culture, if you think about it, has failed a lot of players, including on this Heat team. Like, Derek Williams was cut midway through the season. Why didn't the culture affect him?
Because he wasn't down
like,
with the culture.
Why wasn't he infected with the culture? Why wasn't Greg Oden infected with the culture?
Eddie
like,
Curry.
It, right, Eddie Curry. I'm like, any number of players have come and gone. I mean, how many different players did they try on that 2010-11 team that got to play with LeBron James and still weren't any good? Carlos Arroyo and Mike Bittman and Zydrunas Sokauskas and everyone that played on that team, why weren't they infected with culture? Like, to me, yes. Did James Johnson overachieve? Without question. Did Tyler Johnson overachieve? Your boy Tyler Johnson? Without question. Like, to me, yes, all of that happened, but it doesn't necessarily, like, mean that it's foolproof or that it's distinctly better than other teams in the NBA. Like,
I have a counter to that. And while I agree with you that sometimes people take it to a level that I think is unreasonable, but I think what they mean by culture and what people talking about it mean, like, they have a system in place where they want guys to be as fit as they can. And not saying that they're the only team in the league that does that, right? But they have clear hierarchy of power. They have very good structure because the same people have been there forever. And I think as you start adding things, you whittle down the teams that have this rigid structure that has people that have been there for a while. I think most people in that organization with any meaningful position knows that they're not doing it for their job, right? So they can do it freely and safely. Players do tend to get very fit here. There is very good coaching. And the general manager does a pretty good job of surrounding the team with what they need when they need it, right? So LeBron's here. He found shooters and defenders. And when they don't have a lot of cap space, he gets minimum guys and they kind of throw stuff at the wall and see what works. But
I think you hit on the most important point on all of it, actually. And it's actually something I never considered before. Job security.
Everyone has job security.
Right. It is like almost the most essential part of this, because if you think about it, like the whole concept of right of coaching LeBron James, right? It was actually one of the interesting parts of Woj's podcast with Spo, when he was saying when Spo was talking about how he sat down for lunch one day with LeBron James and said, "Do you want to be coached?" And he said, "Yes." And Spo's follow-up was, "How do you want to be coached?" And the only way that you can really get at LeBron, or even do, like, for example, what Popovich did the other night to Pau Gasol, who, you know, might have taken less money to go to San Antonio and on national television is getting reamed out by Greg Popovich. Like, the only way that you can do that is if you know that the owner is on the side of management, the coach, more than even the player. Like, if you had said, like, who does Mickey Arison have the back of more, Pat Riley or LeBron James, he'd say Pat Riley. And that is in a way, how you build a real lasting organizational culture. And it's the same thing with Belichick in New England, and even to a certain extent, like a guy like Mike Tomlin. Yeah, right, San Antonio, or you think of like, Mike, you know, Tomlin's Mike Tomlin in Pittsburgh, because they don't fire coaches. They just don't. As an organization, they don't fire coaches. And you can have a down year and you'll be fine. And we can let, you know, whatever random defensive player go and we'll still be fine. Like, in a way, the only way to build job security, to build culture, is with job security. And that's what the Heat have. And in a way, what makes them unique, because so many other coaches get fired after, you see, you know, Derek Fisher get fired after a year. And like, for example, this year, the Knicks not respecting Jeff Hornacek, because they just, you know, they know, all right, if we're not going to run the triangle, and if we don't do it, then Jeff Hornacek will get fired. The next guy will come in. Like, in a way, that is how you build something bigger, is if the front office people prove to be bigger than the players, which can hurt you at times when LeBron James goes and leaves, because he doesn't want that to be the case. But it does allow you to build something sustainable.
Yeah, but Chris, like, also, the people doing these jobs are competent. Like, Eric Spoelstra is not
right.
Jeff
exactly.
Hornacek. Pat Riley is not Phil Jackson. Andy Ellisberg is a good general manager. He's great with numbers. Like, you have these people.
The Dolphins have tried to build a culture. They just have never picked the right people to do it.
And that's because, the thing. And they keep doing it in parts, right? So, like, they'll keep the coach but keep the old general manager. Then they keep the general manager and bring another guy in. And everyone there is, I don't want to say scared for, I don't think Adam Gase is scared for his job, but, like, they have a history of people either coaching or general managering for their job. And mm-hmm. Andy Ellisberg knows that no one's going to take his job. So,
right.
And Pat, so like they, he and Andy, Pat and Andy, can try things like sign James Johnson. They don't have to do a panic move like give Joakim money to get people. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, so that and gives
like,
them the
and they don't feel like, and this is something that I don't think we take into consideration enough when it comes to basketball or even personnel moves regardless of sport, which is the need to fulfill the business side of whatever it is you're doing, right? So, for example, the Heat last year, as a purely business move, giving Dwayne Wade all of the money makes all of the sense, because last year, the attendance, while they did technically sell out every game, you can tell it changed. Right, you can tell the arena was a little thinner, the crowd wasn't as loud, and in a way, that wouldn't have happened if Dwayne Wade does not leave. It wouldn't have happened. And so Mickey Arison or another owner could have said, "No, we're keeping Dwayne Wade regardless."
Jim Buss.
Or right, yeah, you do what the Lakers did with Kobe and say, "You're keeping him. We're keeping him because we have to fulfill our obligations to our cable network. We have to sell tickets and we have to maintain relevancy." And the fact that the Heat don't feel any of those pressures is how you're allowed to make decisions like letting Dwayne Wade go to Chicago, whether you think it for basketball reasons to be the right thing or not. At the very least, they have the freedom to do it.
Did you see the Instagram post that Dwayne put up the other day?
The one of him returning to Miami with the luxury cars? With the luxury cars?
He used the word coming home.
Yeah.
Very, well. Like, I don't know the conversation's kind of difficult because I'm not even talking about what he wants,
mm-hmm.
what the organization would want.
Right.
Because at this point, like, And I think anyone who listens to the show or follows me on Twitter knows how I feel about Dwayne and how I still feel about Dwayne.
And it makes me sick, and it's very sappy.
I know. It's really sappy, and I write all very sorts sappy. Of sappy. Yeah. I'm king of sappy. But would the team take him? Like, if he wants to come back at a deal that's somewhat reasonable.
Here's why I would say no. To me, all the hard parts of branching or sort of moving on from your team legend that has perhaps gone a bit past what he used to be, you did it already. And here's to me the amazing part, right? Is that so all summer long and at the start of the season when the Heat started poorly, the conversation was like, did Dwayne Wade win the exchange? Like, did he prove to be the more valuable part of this exchange? And you sort of had to deal with the political ramifications of perhaps, despite Pat Riley will always forever be golden by virtue of having brought three titles to Miami, like perhaps his approval rating wasn't as high. If you think of it in like political terms, it wasn't as high as what it once was. There was some kind of sourness around the organization at 11.
Management stock was as low as it's ever been.
Right. But then you go 30-11. You have the great end to the season. You have this Wright Thompson article come out about Riley, and you kind of get to relive like what a magician he is and what he does.
Deion Waiters.
Like, right, Deion Waiters happens. James Johnson happens. These young guys develop.
You didn't even mention the Bosch fiasco.
Right. Like, you've moved on from all the difficult stuff. All the difficult stuff is behind you of all, you know, trying to figure out who your number one guy is supposed to be, trying to figure out all the difficulties in figuring, you know, in your post-Dwayne Wade era. You did it in a year. You accomplished everything that you needed to do, and now you can start to think for your future. In a way, does he come back into the team and say, all right, I'm, you know, I'll adjust to your style of play, or I'll adjust to what you're doing? No would be my guess. My guess would be like it's the same as it ever was. He still gets the ball at the end of the game. The offense is still is run on his terms. Like, to me, you've done all the difficult parts of separating from a superstar past his prime. Why would you, in a way, invite some of those difficulties back?
The reason why I ask, and the reason why I think the conversation is so interesting, because in the Wright Thompson piece, Riley, like, he continually, and he said throughout, since Dwayne left, that he probably would have done things differently. And in the Wright Thompson article, he always said,
I don't think so.
I mean, that's what he says publicly. Now, that's the other thing. It's what he says publicly versus what he feels, because at the end of the day, Riley's a salesperson. But, you know, a lot of times we say bleep because we know we're never going to have to face that bleep.
Right.
So now Riley might be confronted with that bleep.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Well, I guess the other thing, too, that you have to consider is that one day they're going to have a ceremony that honors Dwayne Wade and raises his number to the Raptors, and they put a statue outside of the arena in honor of him. So do you need to be talking in, you know, a year after you've let your all-time franchise player go, you're still saying negative things about him in public? I still would imagine he harbors very private thoughts about the way that that all went down and the talk to my agent stuff. Like, to me, he does have to present a public face on this one still. I don't know if he still has to on LeBron, because I will imagine they'll raise his number to the rafters one day, but that relationship isn't so personal. You know what I mean? Like, it was 4 years, and it was championships, but it wasn't quite the, we saw you grow, you've been with us the entire time, and you're kind of one of the few NBA players that actually got to live out that life. Like, to me, those are drastically different situations, but in a way, I don't see how a team that now has the ability to look towards their future with, you know, a lottery pick this year, with the ability, you know, to get some more cap space if they let go of Bosch, with some young players developing, why would you then kind of reverse course and do something different and perhaps invite some of, like, not the basketball issues, but like the political issues of your club legend playing for you again? Why would you invite that back? Like, after you've done all the difficult parts of, you know, taking the hit and ticket sales,
you're over the breakup. And you're not crying. You're right. You're over it already. You're not crying anymore. You're not drinking too much anymore. You're going back to the gym. You feel good. And then they show up in your life again. And then what do you do?
Right, exactly. Like, you've gotten over the emotional heartache. Like, you know, the ex-girlfriend shows up in your life and maybe you think, oh, you know, it was so good that we should give it a go. But in a way, it ended for a reason. And so now let's live separate lives and call it a life.
It's like, you know, when you get back in a relationship and your partner is doing all the things that they used to do to annoy you.
Right, right, so, right, so exactly. Then,
you know, like, once Dwayne is chucking up bad shots at the end of fourth quarters and you're like, oh, why did I get back?
The first time he, like, you know, is yelling at a referee and not getting back on defense. again with this?
That'll be cute the first time, though. It'll be,
right.
Oh,
right.
Yeah, I miss this.
Back again. Oh,
game,
man.
50 against the Hornets. You know, you're, not again.
You're 24 and 26. And you need a big win on the road.
Oh, my God.
And there's Dwayne Wade ambling back from a missed layup and a non-call.
Middle of a West Coast trip. Everybody's groggy. Yeah. You're mad.
I would say the circus trip, but RIP circus trip.
Finally. That ended Chris Bosh's career.
That's a good point. Twice.
Twice.
Yeah.
This damn circus.
That damn circus, man.
Nobody asked
for it. So what do we now get home games in January now?
I know.
Or do they fill it with something else?
But
like, do they have,
nice.
Like, right, exactly. Well, I feel like January, like, if I was a Minnesota Timberwolf, I'd be like, oh man, we can't play road games in January in Miami because of the circus. That stinks.
Now we're happy. But not, Pitbull might have like a week long concert or something. Yeah, you never know.
Yeah, right. Yeah, maybe you have like a like this, and I hate Pit. Hey, I hate Pitbull with the heat of a thousand suns.
Why?
But well, first off, okay, there's a number of reasons, but the number one reason,
I have a list, but at the top of it,
oh no, I've thought a lot about this. I might write a dissertation at some point. The number one reason would be, particularly of late, is that I would like to know the answer to these questions. Number one, does he produce the music, / does he identify the music that will occur over these songs? Number two, does he find the featured singers? Because the featured singers on his songs have become the star of his songs. Like, for example, the song Greenlight. I believe the artist that does like the main chorus is this guy called Lunch Money. Right, like, to me, Timber is a great example. Like, Kesha is the star of that song. There are more talented singers on his own songs than him, and then he comes on, and it's always the same verse about trying to sexually please a woman. Like, it's the same verse. You've heard it 10,000 times on 10,000 different songs. Like, can you come up with a different topic to sing about? A way to approach it, even? Like, it's the same song, the same lyrics. You've heard them 10,000 times. Can you do something unique, Pitbull? That's all I ask.
What is Pitbull's target audience? Because I feel like millennials all hate him. I feel like it's your parents trying to be cool. I feel like
That is a good point. That is a good point. I don't know if all millennials hate him. I feel like there's a new market for ironically liking things that you know are bad.
Oh, my God. That's such a great point. Yes.
And I feel like Pitbull is like the number one thing in that area.
Chris, I have not heard. But yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
There is indeed a new market for that.
Yeah. Like, there's a market for like movies that are so bad they're good.
Yeah.
For like social media jokes. Like, for example, like the new pun market, right? Like, those are like, some of them are clever, but some of them are so bad that they're good.
Sharknado.
Right. Like Greg Cody on the Levitard show, things like that, things that are like not intentionally bad, but like are bad, but are turned to be good.
Sharknado.
Right. Exactly. Right. Sharknado is a perfect example. Sharknado goes viral. Everyone's talking about Sharknado, but it's horrific.
Chris, but what's more fun than live tweeting Sharknado?
Oh, it's amazing.
Like, come on. Like, it's the best.
It's absolutely, like, the last, I think, for the second and the third one, I wasn't home to watch it on first time of asking, but in a way, it's like an award show.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Like you have to watch an award show live, or else why even bother? Like, I feel like I have not seen the last two Sharknados because, well, if I wasn't home to watch it the first time with Twitter, then what's the point?
Exactly. Like, when the celebrity
Frankie
cameo. What happened, Brian?
You missed a Frankie Muniz one.
Frankie Muniz was... Dude.
He was on one of those?
Yes. Okay, but Frankie Muniz took his role so damn seriously.
Oh,
like,
that's
Frankie
amazing.
Muniz
that's
felt
so good.
Like, this was his road back to stardom. Like, they cast Frankie Muniz, and he, like, acted. He acted.
That is so funny.
It was so great. Oh, my God.
To me, the peak Sharknado. I don't know if it was in the first one, right, where he dives through the shark with the chainsaw, and like comes out the other side.
I think that is.
And you see, like,
yes,
him like breaking the flat. Like, that is like the peak Like when my Twitter feed was like, "Are you freaking kidding me
they
with this show?"
They were in space last time, weren't they, Brian?
Really?
They're everywhere.
They were in space. Right. I believe that Sharknado went to space because every
I have to see where he dies.
Every
Spoiler.
Movie franchise was in space.
What?
Well, isn't Fast and Furious going to space too?
Yeah.
Are they?
Yeah. They need
I think
to,
so.
They need to stop. I read a report.
To me, that's the one. Well, now people have told me that like post Tokyo Drift, the movies are actually okay.
No.
Like the 4 through 7,
they lied.
Or 4 through 8, I guess right now. But like to me, the fact that this will just continue in perpetuity, right?
Yes.
Yeah. For sure.
And to me, the thing that's crazy is right. So I got into an argument with a coworker about this the other day, where like where they were talking about Game of Thrones. And how like they're gonna start doing spin-offs of Game of Thrones, like of just individual characters, and then you know like it's gonna be Game of Thrones, and it's basically all a cash grab, right?
Yeah.
And to me, it's like it's one of those things, right? Where like people get mad at ESPN for talking about Tim Tebow all day long, even though I would presume when they talk about Tim Tebow all day long, their ratings go up. Like I wonder what is like the line of demarcation of like when we'll get exhausted of Fast and Furious movies, not just as a country, but like as a globe,
as a species,
right? As a globe, because like I remember reading opening weekend of the Fast 8 that more people watched it in like more people watched it in China than they did in the United States, like, by dollar amount.
Love, because that's a novelty overseas. Like even if you know. My family in Colombia or Venezuela, like that's enough.
I saw like Colombia was like number five.
All about
in the
that.
World, watching the Fast movies. All right, so here in the United States, I'm looking this up now. The domestic total is 208 million. The China total is 383 million.
Jesus,
like that's ridiculous.
Why?
I don't know.
I don't know. Like my mom loves those movies, and I go, "Mom, why?" She's like, "They're fun," and I was like, "No, they're not. They're bad."
Yeah, 1.165 billion worldwide so far.
When I, you know, back to your Game of Thrones point, like when I heard that originally, I had the same reaction you did. I recoiled. I was like, "Oh, why? Just let it go away." And I always have that reaction. But some, like, I don't watch Game of Thrones, so I don't know. But I do think. I think sometimes series deserve a spinoff to kind of fill in holes. Maybe post-canon, maybe prequels, maybe in between. Like, I do think sometimes it's clearly a cash grab, but sometimes it works. You know what I mean?
Better like, Call Saul is like a
perfect people say that about. I was just going to bring up that example of Better Call Saul.
I only know anime, so that's all I have. But yeah, that's a good example, Brian. Thank you.
you literally don't watch any serialized television with like humans?
Well, I used to really love 24, and then that ended.
Oh,
well, I'm not watching the new 24 because Jack Bauer's not in it, so it's not 24.
Okay.
I am really behind in New Girl and It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, and I think that's about it.
If they didn't make because I know you used to watch How I Met Your Mother. If they made a spinoff of that show, would you watch it?
No, I would not watch it because they don't need it. Like, what would they make the spinoff of?
The kids. I don't know.
That'd be terrible.
Like once you get to 7 seasons of something, like you're done. It's over. You don't have to do anymore.
That's my point. And I think that's my main gripe with American television is that they don't know when to stop. Like,
well, when they stop is when they stop making money.
I know, but like that is so detrimental to art because you drag out a story that doesn't need like. How I Met Your Mother is a good example. It did not need to be that long.
No, it didn't.
It didn't. They could have half.
You could stop at season 6, and that's it. Like to
even
me,
even that is long. But you know what I mean.
Agreed. But like to me, no show should last longer than 6 seasons.
And like
even a show like the Simpsons, where like because they're so creative and they bring in new people every year, they can kind of carry on. But like, I mean, is anyone watching Simpsons season 22? Like,
have good ideas for that long with your world? Like, no, that's like. And you say 6 seasons, Chris? I'm used to shows that are 2 to 3 seasons. Like,
the crazy thing about shows that get exported from England, it's like there's 6 episodes and they're 2 seasons.
Yeah,
and like, and that's it.
Sherlock, yeah,
right. Or even like the original Office is on Netflix.
Wait, what? The original? We don't have the original Office?
No,
we copied that.
Yeah, no, it's an English show with Ricky Gervais.
Oh, I didn't know that.
You didn't know that?
The more you know. Yeah, no, I just thought The Office was with...
I thought that was common knowledge. The original one is Ricky Gervais in England.
Cool.
It's like 12 total episodes. It's crazy. And here, The Office got popular and they made like 7 seasons of it.
Like, anime typically runs 24 episodes and 22 minutes each episode. So, like, for me, that is a good, complete, and closed story. So, like, when I see...
It's like digestible.
Yeah, Game of Thrones, I can't watch it because it's like 6 seasons and it's like an hour each episode. And I'm like, that's too long.
Can we talk about your anime judgment for a moment?
Sure, yeah. What about it?
How tired are you of like a lack of cultural understanding with your anime things? And also, my follow-up would be, because like I have a lot of things like this in my life where I'm so dorky about something, but I can't talk about it with anyone. Like, have you found people, not just online, but in life, that you can share your dorkitude with?
Well, to answer your second question first, I started an anime Twitter account, and I made my own friends over there.
Okay,
and,
that's
started,
good.
And I started a YouTube channel because I needed to express myself creatively.
Brilliant. Fantastic.
But my friends that I grew up with, you know, we like basketball and anime, so I, you know, I get best of both worlds. So, and
my sister
as well. To answer first question, I think it's funny. Like, when people make the, I think Heat Boner made a joke the other day. There was a blow up doll, somebody buying a ring for a blow up doll.
What's his new name? Is it Priapism?
Yes, which I just learned what that meant the other day.
Yeah. Tremendous.
Yes, this is amazing. And he made a joke that was me, and I think that's funny. But like I do feel like it's such an underappreciated medium, because it is like, it does have paramount storytelling. Just what people think it is, it's tentacles and yelling and fighting, which is not what it is. So, I kind of get it, cuz it's a little weird, and sometimes it's a little weird, but sometimes it's incredible.
Right, and it's like one of those things, and I kind of run into this all the time, because I don't start with a objection or a sort of a bias against things that are foreign in really any capacity. And I, like, that is like the starting point on anime, right? So it's cartoons that are not of this country. Like, what is this?
I think it's mostly that it's cartoons. I don't think the of this country matters as much as it's just cartoons. And when people I think when people see cartoons that are not comedy, I think that it's like for like adults, like Family Guy, Simpsons, American Dad, like they see that and automatically they think, why would
Do you think like the original like the first year that The Simpsons came out and became popular, there was some objection to it because it was animated?
I don't know. That's a good question, and
I would think so.
Yeah, I guess so. But The Simpsons made it very abundantly clear from the jump that it was marketed to adults. And actually, The Simpsons put Fox on the map. The Simpsons made Fox.
The Simpsons and the NFL.
Yeah, that's what the reason why Fox is the company that it is today is because of The Simpsons and the NFL. Primarily, The Simpsons and its popularity from the start. So yeah. I don't really know how much resistance they got, but I get it. Like, on the onset, you look at and the stuff, and anime is in itself a meme, and the things that go viral are the weird things, because it's quirky. It's supposed to be quirky, but it's also not quirky. You know, some people take it, like Alf was making fun of me a couple shows ago when I'm arguing about directing an anime. He's like, "What directing is there?" And I'm like, "This is such a nuanced conversation."
Well, that's ridiculous.
There is directing.
I mean, it's just a ridiculous argument to make.
What, Alf or mine?
No, Alf. Oh yeah, it's good stuff. Like, well, and this is like something I get into when I introduce like sporting concepts into American sport, like from abroad into American sports. Like this week, like a major talking point in baseball is the idea of ties being incorporated into sports. What? I think basketball could just as easily incorporate ties into their sport. Like, if a game is, you know, after 48 minutes it's tied, then game's tied. That's it. We're done.
And you and I both like soccer.
Right.
I understand why there are ties. I don't necessarily like them,
but I don't object to them. To me, I've kind of come to terms with by watching soccer a lot. Like, because if you support a team, then you kind of know how a game is supposed to go. So like I watch Man City. They're my team, and they played against Middlesbrough 2 weeks ago.
Bandwagon.
I went to go see them in person, so that's my cheat code. And by the way, if you're picking a soccer team, why not bandwagon? Like, if you're in Europe and you have no allegiance to any team, why wouldn't you have, if you're like becoming an NBA fan in 2012, why wouldn't you have picked Miami? Of course you would have.
I don't.
Because it's fun.
I don't disagree because I did the same with tennis, so I can't make fun of you. Oh.
Right. Yeah. But so I was watching the game and I knew like, okay, this game is a draw. Like just the way that the game played out, and if there was another goal, it would have felt to me like harsh on either team that's how the game ended. But like to me, I've just like come to terms with like a tie is an outcome. Like if teams are even on the day, that's an outcome. Like because we've set time limits on these sports, be it 9 innings or 60 minutes or 48 minutes or whatever. Like if after 48 minutes the game is ended. Then the game has ended. And like, I've kind of come to terms with the idea that, yes, it is an outcome that's acceptable.
But I don't feel like if my team's playing, and like, for example, I think the most recent example, the U.S. men's national team playing a qualifier in Panama. We know that a tie is fine there, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it felt good.
No, but I also think like the tie, like a tie was a fair result in that game.
No, like, but
if you watch a game, like, the game should have ended in a tie.
Yeah, but it doesn't make me feel good.
No, it does not. But, I mean, when your team loses, it doesn't make you feel good. Like,
Portugal, United States.
Oh my God.
I was at Fado's. Were you there?
No, I was not. Oh, I was at home.
Chris, that was...
I don't know if I can be around people during World Cup games.
No, that was fun, like, man. That was the most fun I've ever had watching sports.
That's there are a few things that give me sporting angst. Like, I remember the legitimate sporting angst I felt like ahead of Game 6 in Boston. Like, I was ill that day because I was so nervous.
You know, I'm alone that I didn't feel the gravity of that game.
Oh, no. I remember I worked that morning... And I was exhausted. I went home, I went to bed, and I woke up 5 minutes before tip-off. Like, and because otherwise I couldn't have dealt with, like, how... And I remember even after, like, LeBron clearly demonstrated in the first quarter, like, we're not losing tonight. Like, I was still terrified of that game. Like, I was still like, all right, you know, when's the comeback coming? Like, the entire time I was mortified. But, like, ahead of the opening game of the World Cup, the United States playing Ghana... Like I was physically ill that day. Like my stomach
physically
was hurting.
Physically ill?
Physically ill, yeah. And then they scored in 32 seconds and I was fine.
But then Ghana scored.
But like
again.
Yeah, well, yeah, and then John Brooks scored again. But yeah. I remember how crestfallen I think even more than the Wando not scoring against Belgium. Like I think that goal from Ronaldo's cross against Portugal. Just because of like how much enthusiasm there would have been for two World Cup wins to start the tournament.
That was the most painful goal I've ever experienced in my life.
Yeah.
Easy.
The Brazil
either,
one?
Either no,
the Portugal one, the
yeah,
Portugal
the
one.
Portugal. It's either that one or the goal that Ghana scored to put them up in the 2010 World Cup.
Oh yeah. But that's another one where like I kind of you know, right? Just based off of watching your team play, like whether or not they should win or lose today.
No, Chris, they were better than that. They were better than Ghana. I'm sorry. No.
On that day?
Yeah, they were better. I'm sorry.
You think so? Yeah. I thought the entire time that Ghana was the team that felt more like scoring.
That I think that was the best U.S. soccer team ever.
You think so?
Yeah, I think that's the best.
I think any team that has Christian Pulisic on it now is by virtue of
he's
that better.
He's so
team.
Good.
He's so good.
He's so good. I can't believe we're talking soccer in the show. I'm so happy.
I love this. I love this.
I know. Alf is probably seething.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
when
maybe.
Alf listens to this,
well, how about this? How about show up on time for the pod?
Yeah,
and this
Alf,
won't happen.
How about don't not go to a bar and have fun?
Right.
Instead, show up and do what we're supposed
right.
to do as
That's
we're
right.
contractually obligated by Almighty Baller. Hmm?
Right, uh-huh. Brian, did you say who when we referred to Christian Pulisic?
Yes.
That's an insult. You need to get to know the greatest American soccer player who's ever lived.
Who could we compare him to in the NBA?
The greatest soccer player?
Say again?
Lennon Donovan's not the greatest soccer player?
No. Christian Pulisic is. Mm. He's 18 years old. He's 18 years old. He's already the best soccer player that's ever lived.
Linson Dempsey's the greatest soccer player?
I hate that take, Chris. I hate it. And
hate the take?
I don't know if you're serious or not, but like I hate that take.
No, he's the best American soccer player that's ever lived. Already.
No, Chris. Chris?
Because I don't necessarily do best based off of accomplishments. Like this is also like a basketball thing, right? Where like, well, people will say, well, Michael, you know, well, LeBron can't be better than Jordan because he hasn't won as many championships. Well, like when I compare best player, I don't do like resume accomplishment listing. I do like, okay, when they're at their best, when they display their best qualities, who is the better player?
Hold on, with Chris. And to me, Chris, when Landon Donovan was at his best, they gave Spain their only defeat in 5 years.
Yeah. No, I agree with you.
You know what I mean?
I know, I understand. But that wasn't a I don't think that game was a tribute to Landon Donovan.
He was a like major factor. And then the next game in Brazil, when they were up 2-0.
They were 2-0 up at the half, yeah. That's kind of like the low-key like result in U.S. history was getting to a cup final and being 2-0 up at the half. But it was funny. That was still at a point where you were afraid enough of Brazil.
It was like playing
in quicksand where it's like, all right, this is going to fall apart.
That's when they were good. My God, are you watching the Celtic Wizards game?
No, I'm watching the hockey game right now. What's going on in the Celtics game?
The Wizards are getting demolished.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Well, that's a bummer.
You know what I've really liked? I like when Washington really plays up on the Thomas pick and roll. Like, it's at halftime now. I see you're changing it.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, I love when the Wizards really push up on that pick and roll because it really forces Isaiah to either dump the ball really, really quick or it just gives Washington, like, they force Isaiah out of the play.
Right. Well, and didn't he like take like a series or a season low in shots in game 3?
I think so.
Because they just kept forcing him to get rid of the ball. I was reading an article about like kind of the adjustments that that series has been like the adjustment series, right? Because like they keep deploying new tactics and new lineups, and like each of them appears to have worked. So the series has swung like a million different ways.
That's been the best series this postseason, I think.
What? I think Rockets Spurs is better just because it's featured like more closeness in games.
No, I just because the two Washington games that were blowouts, one of them was interesting because they were fighting the whole damn time,
right?
And the second one, you don't trust Washington.
No, because they're so bad on defense.
So like you're watching to see the catastrophe. Like I think,
yeah.
And to be honest, Chris, the other series that I think is the second best was the Pacers Cavs series.
Oh yeah, no, that was a good series.
Games were good.
Yeah, agreed, and they were all close. And it's like, why I thought Toronto had a chance.
Well, we all thought Toronto had a chance.
Yeah, I guess to me, like never. One of the things that we always fail to remember when it comes to the Cavs in the playoffs is that they get vacations. Each of the last 3 years, they've gotten vacations. If at any point of the season, an NBA team got 8 days off. You'd be like, oh yeah, they're gonna come out like and be a lot fresher and better.
Yeah, because they're playing garbage,
right? Like, well, like how is Toronto that bad? I still don't understand. Like, that's a math equation I don't get.
I feel like you can't like that offense that they run is so easy to defend. Like, if you're gonna sit there and watch film and you're gonna tell guys with Cleveland had time to prepare because they had days off. If you sit there in a film room and say, "This is how we're gonna defend them," that's easy.
Right, and they don't really have like a counterpunch of like they can go to like this sophisticated offense or run these sets or whatever. It's very basic. But
okay, coach.
Right,
he cannot help them.
Maybe they have a good defensive coach or they have a good motivating coach, but certainly not a good strategically offensive coach.
I think there are different coaches for different things, right? Like, so if you have a young team, you'd want a certain type of coach. You might not want Phil Jackson coaching a bunch of young guys. You know what I mean?
Like, right, I think Scott Brooks is perfect for a young team.
Yes, but as we've seen, Scott Brooks has limitations.
Right, exactly. You know? Like
Dwayne Casey has limitations.
He doesn't have that offensive sophistication. Like I think Dwayne Casey would be perfect for if Minnesota didn't have Tibbs, I'd say go get Dwayne Casey. Because you can grow with Dwayne Casey from here to here, but to get from here to here. You gotta. I'm doing it with my hands, by the way, for the pod listeners.
It's not a visual medium, Chris. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I'm sorry. I've now gotten used to visual medium again. Right. Yeah. Exactly. I'm back to my audio roots. But getting back to a point I was making earlier about changing my mind about playoff series. I remember when I worked with Chris Perkins at 790, he would always talk about the idea of players that win you best of sevens, and that always kind of rang like hollow like a cliche to me. But now that I've watched these playoffs. And I've seen Toronto fall apart. And I've seen, you see, like, Utah. Like, yes, they beat the Clippers, but they were ultimately kind of exposed. And like, to me, like, I don't know if Gordon Hayward is one of those guys, because you saw at the end,
it wasn't his fault.
No, I understand. It's the Warriors. They're overwhelming. But I meant more like in the Clippers series, right? Did you not find it weird that Joe Johnson ran their end of game? Because I did. I'm watching Utah, and I'm waiting for Gordon Hayward to take over, for Gordon Hayward to run a set, and it was Joe Johnson. Like yes, he's ISO Joe, and yes, he probably hurts you in the regular season doing that kind of stuff.
Advantage in that series, though, because Joe Johnson was playing against guards, as in J.J. Redick and Jamal Crawford.
But Gordon Hayward could have just as easily drawn those same matchups.
But Joe Johnson's so much, and number one, Joe had it going.
Right? No, agreed.
When Joe has it going and you have two pretty awful defenders defending you, and at the end of games, if you're going to run ISO anyway, might as well do it. Like, I don't look at that as a pejorative to Gordon Hayward, when if we saw in the next series, he was awesome. Like, against...
Right.
I mean, he's incredible.
No. He was even good within games in that Clipper series where I'm watching him like, yeah, he was good for three quarters, but like... Okay, so there are two Heat players that I'll use as an example for this. The first is Goran Dragic. I love Goran Dragic as a player. I love his style. I love what he does. And just in general, who Goran Dragic represents. But at the end of games, he goes and stands in the corner. And even at the end of this season, in games that they had to win, like in key late-game possessions, like the ball was in Tyler Johnson's hands before it was in Goran Dragic's hands. And I found that weird. Like... while that is kind of a very old school NBA like way to analyze the game, like you just kind of see it more and more, or at least I've started to notice more and more like how much that matters. And then the other example I'll use that's like an example of playoff basketball is Justice Winslow. Like, the reason why Justice Winslow is ultimately fatally flawed as a basketball player is that when you get in a playoff series, how often do you see teams picking on the worst, or at least a specific lack of a skill,
Tony Allen.
Right, Tony Allen, or like even you mentioned the Celtics series. In game four, they just said every time Isaiah Thomas is being hidden on someone who's bigger than him, we're just going to go at him. Regardless of side of the floor, they're going to use the skill that you have the least against you. So do you have players that can't be picked on regardless of situations? And if you're 6'6", which is what Justice Winslow is, you cannot have a skill like his lack of shooting that stands out that much and can easily be removed from a series. We saw it during the playoffs last year, and unless that demonstrably improves, like, that is ultimately going to be something that's hard to build around.
I actually thought...
He said his hair.
God, Brian, have you heard Brian's take, Chris?
No, I have not.
Brian, do you want to share?
Winslow's fro got to go.
Brian believes that the Justice Winslow hair is impeding his shooting motion, because his hair. So when he shoots, his hand.
Oh, didn't you do like video analysis on this, Brian? Like I remember someone like taking me through the video or like the picture shot by shot of his shooting mechanics and how the hair alters it.
There are pictures, yes.
Yeah.
Because when he did not have the fro in Summer League, he was shooting amazing.
Mm.
There was no hair. He had whatever he had going on.
To obtrude the arm angle.
Yeah, he doesn't have like a bad looking shot. This is weird. It's not.
I mean,
terrible.
It's just bad. Like I remember like even watching like him in warmups shoot jumpers from the elbow, and it was bad. Like there were times he would airball them or only like graze the rim or hit only the backboard. Like for whatever reason. So when I was doing the radio show, we'd do it live from the arena. And we'd be done at like 6:30, and it always happened to be Winslow that was warming up at that time. And I just watch him put jumper after jumper after jumper, and it just wasn't good. And like to me, that's one of those things where if you could fix it, you would. Like,
I don't know. I think you can. I mean, James Johnson was not a good shooter ever, and he became not a good one, but a serviceable one.
Yeah.
Like James Johnson was not a good shooter this year, but
like Jason Kidd figured it out like in year 15.
I hate that we use him as an example.
What for
dude,
shooting?
He's a Hall of Fame talent. Like,
I'm talking about that specific skill. Like it is now like shooting can now almost become overstated in a way because it is so important that like, oh, if you're not a good shooter, you're not a good player. But like, I understand what you're saying about Jason Kidd, where he was otherwise an unbelievable player.
Yeah.
But to me, in terms of developing that later in the career, like, you remember the examples of those that do more than the many more who don't. And, like, that to me is the biggest concern that the Heat should have with Justice Winslow, is that it just doesn't seem like it's ever going to come. And I know it's harsh to do on a year and a quarter's evidence, but if it doesn't happen soon, then I would be really concerned if I was Miami.
Brian.
Yes.
You've talked pretty much the same amount this show that you do every show.
You guys hijacked the show.